From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll speak with the authors of Choosing Love to explore how people can identify as both conservative Christians and LGBTQ+.
So here is dialogue happening among conservative Protestants talking about sexuality and gender. And I just, you know, I was like, I have to figure out what's going on here. I was really curious and really fascinated.
Then two recent Milwaukee grads heading off to college share their fears about leaving their undocumented parents behind. Plus, we'll learn about an exhibit at the Maritime Museum that helps people learn where the fish that they eat comes from.
To see all the people that are bringing us the fish that we eat, you know, behind the scenes, but that create kind of a work family, if you will.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. Religion offers people of faith many things, including support and a sense of community. However, for LGBTQ+ people, their relationship with religion, specifically Christianity, can be difficult. Trying to live authentically within a system that may explicitly deny who they are can present many challenges. This piqued the interest of a couple Marquette University professors who researched what happens when two identities that seem in total opposition are joined together. Dawn Moon and Teresa Tobin explore how LGBTQ+ Christians and their allies are working to make their families, churches, and communities more inclusive in their book, Choosing Love. Moon and Tobin join me now to talk about the book and the people who help shape it. You both worked on this book, Choosing Love. So can you start us off by introducing yourselves and sharing how you both came together to start this unique research back in 2014?
So I'm a sociologist who has been studying religion and gender and sexuality since the 1990s. And I started this project when I first heard about the movement among evangelical LGBTQ+ people when my partner's cousin, who was evangelical, came out, and other people in his immediate family were trying to figure out how they should respond and approached me and asked like what I thought was the proper Christian response to homosexuality, which I thought was an odd thing for him to be asking me at the time since I'm not religious, but he knew that I studied it. And we started swapping articles. And from him, I learned that these organizations had started up and that this movement was happening. And it just seemed like everything that I had been studying in my life up to that point had like come together. Because in addition to being interested in how U.S. Protestants were navigating questions around gender and sexuality, I had also been taking some time studying dialogue, and particularly the Jewish-Palestinian dialogue movement. And so here was dialogue happening among conservative Protestants talking about sexuality and gender. And I just, you know, I was like, I have to figure out what's going on here. I was really curious and really fascinated. And then I had the opportunity to apply for a grant from the Templeton Religion Trust that required me to work with someone in the humanities. And I remembered that Teresa had done research on spiritual violence and seemed like a good partner for the project.
Yeah, so Teresa, can you share a bit more about your background and the lens that you brought to this?
Yeah, definitely. So I'm a moral philosopher. I work primarily in contemporary ethics and social philosophy from a feminist perspective. And I've always been interested in ethical questions that arise at the intersection of people's faith experiences and spirituality and gender and sexuality. And both from a, you know, philosophical perspective, but also a personal perspective. I'm Roman Catholic, and I grew up with a background and lots of questions around that intersection. And in 2010, I started to read testimony from survivors of the clergy sexual abuse crisis. And a lot of them were naming spiritual violence as a harm of that form of abuse that was not getting a lot of attention. So the idea of spiritual violence when your religion and your religious upbringing and authorities and rituals and practices are actually used to harm people spiritually and to erect barriers to their relationship with God. And I was so impacted by that term. And I just thought, I want to study that more. But then also seeing connections between what women and LGBTQ plus folks in Christian communities and Catholic communities in particular were also naming as kind of spiritual harm. So when Dawn approached me, I saw these connections and I was like, oh, I'm doing this thing by myself. But when Dawn approached me with this grant opportunity that, you know, gave birth to a whole new research project and trajectory.
Right. And this research is based on interviews that you've conducted with people in the Midwest, across the nation, who are part of groups that are trying to figure out this intersectionality. So I want to lay out some basic definitions for the listeners related to our conversation and this book. And let's start with the phrase welcoming but not affirming. Can you explain what this means in regard to Christian communities?
Yeah, I can try. So in some Christian spaces, people will say that they are welcoming of LGBTQ plus people, meaning those people are permitted to come to celebrate in the liturgy, to sometimes maybe even participate in ministry, lead the music ministry, be part of the community in that sense. But not affirming then means that the official position of the church is that we don't acknowledge or accept or affirm or celebrate that you are gay or lesbian or transgender. So we're not affirming or accepting your sexuality or your gender identity as something to acknowledge, recognize, and celebrate. But we, you know, we're still saying that's sinful, but you're welcome to be here. We're all sinners. We're all on a journey, and you're welcome to be here and be part of our community. So that's how I've understood that.
Yeah, and this kind of touches upon the whole idea of conditional love that you explore. And as you were saying before, Dawn, these groups are helping people try to understand, like, how do I fit into this place, right? So with this book and the lens that you viewed it in, how do you both define or characterize conservative LGBTQ Christians? Because from an outside perspective, if someone's not practicing or not familiar, a lot of people could assume that this is a bit of an oxymoron, right?
Yeah, I would say that they're conservative Christians in that they use conservative Christian techniques of interpreting the Bible. They tend to be part of conservative Christian culture. Conservative Christian music is the music that speaks to them. They may have, you know, some conservative Christian denominations or independent churches basically teach people ways to channel the Holy Spirit or to have their own conversations with God. And that's formed them. That's who they are. And they're gay, bi, trans, queer. And so a lot of times, and we have encountered this even among other academics, where we say we're talking about the LGBTQ conservative Christian movement, and people are just like, well, that can't exist. The only thing that defines whether you're conservative or not is your stance on gender and sexuality in that case. But that basically is not the foundation of their Christianity. The foundation of their Christianity is their relationship with Jesus. And so the idea that your ideas or your understanding of gender and sexuality would erase all of that seems to give a lot of power to gender and sexuality, right? A lot of power to these social constructions as opposed to people's relationship with the divine.
To kind of navigate this big water, right, of this area of study, the people you're talking to, you do focus on the significance of four emotions in the lives of LGBTQ plus Christians, which is shame, humility, pride, and love. And I'm hoping you both can share some sentiments that you heard over and over from people you interviewed, like some common themes. What are some of the main struggles or some of the main things that are bringing them together?
One thing that started to become clear pretty early on was that an LGBTQ plus person had to constantly be displaying shame in order to be welcome in the group. And so we spent a lot of time looking at what is shame? It like came up all the time. People were really trying to figure out how to navigate it. And scholars across a whole lot of disciplines, you know, philosophy, psychology, sociology, theology, right? They all come down to the idea of shame being a fear of being unworthy of relationships. And so if you're having to constantly demonstrate the people who matter most to you that you know you're unworthy of relationships in order for them to be willing to have a relationship with you and not just throw you out, then you're in this very difficult position where you're having to like just constantly be like, I feel like they love me, but they don't love me. And I love them, but they don't want me too close to them because they think my capacity to love is dangerous to the people that I love. And, you know, like a number of people were told, you know, you can't be around kids, or you can't lead worship, or you can't help people with the dance ministry or whatever it is, because your sin could infect them, right? Or your sin could lead them to a place of doubt, and we can't have that. And that, you know, like constantly being told your capacity to love other people is dangerous. It just really led to a lot of the psychological distress and, you know, feeling like life was not livable for a lot of people.
Before we continue, I'm just going to take a moment to reintroduce you both. If you're just joining us on Lake Effect, I'm Audrey Nowakowski speaking with Dawn Moon and Teresa Tobin, authors of Choosing Love. Their book explores how people can identify as both LGBTQ+ and conservative Christians. So one of the ways you examined how people came out of the other side of this sacramental shame that we were just talking about is through the unique lens of pride. So can you explain to me what you guys are looking at when it comes to pride in this community that's different from a typical Christian lens?
Yeah, I'll start with this one. And I can't talk about pride without talking about humility in this context. So I think for one of the things that's really important about what we learned was the connection between humility and pride. So a lot of the folks we talked to were taught from very, very early on that pride is a sin and that it's one of the deadliest sins, maybe the root of all sin, because they equate pride with arrogance, with sort of elevating yourself above God. And so pride was and is, and a lot of people talked about pride being something that could never be explored, let alone felt. So what we learned from folks was, for many, many people, the first step to healing seems to come through a kind of humility, which is an openness to prioritize what we can learn from our relationships to rethink ourselves and rethink what we know, or at least ask questions about it. And that led many people to experience a kind of a sense of their own fundamental goodness and worthiness. And that's the kind of pride we're talking about. So pride, relational pride, is a kind of confidence and joy in your basic human worthiness, that you're just worthy for love and relationship. It's not elevating you above anyone. It's just a basic sense of your own worthiness. And it's a kind of, it's an emotion that I think a lot of people whose dignity isn't regularly called into question, whose existence isn't regularly called into question, take for granted. But for people who are routinely diminished, to be able to feel your own worthiness and to feel joy in that is pride. That's what people were experiencing, that sense of like, wait a minute, I'm worthy of love and connection, period. It's my birthright too.
So with this lens of humility leading to openness, more relationships, deeper understanding, what does allyship look like to you in this lens?
Yeah, so being an ally also starts from a place of humility, right? Like what Teresa is talking about with humility is letting go of the arrogance to say, I already know everything there is to know. And so to be an ally means you have to listen to the people that you want to be an ally to, and you might have to change something about yourself in order to be an ally. And maybe that thing about yourself is like your understanding of your privileged place in the world, that God loves you best, right? Maybe it's just rethinking what you've always known, right? But being open to like, okay, I'm going to, you know, we heard from one person who spoke at a conference, conservative Christian dad of a young gay man who was like, I'm gay. And he was like, okay, well, I don't want to jeopardize my relationship with my son. But, you know, obviously this is not okay. He's not going to be able to like get married one day, but we're going to study the Bible together. you know, and then he'll see for himself that this isn't possible. And so they studied the Bible together, and they got all the books and the concordances, and, like, you know, they did a real deep dive over months. And the dad was like, oh, I actually didn't realize all this. Huh, I had just assumed that what I knew was fine and right, and I don't have to think about it. But now I'm thinking about it, and I'm realizing I was wrong. And so that allyship comes from both, you know, listening to the people that you want to be an ally to, loving them enough to actually learn from them, and connect with them in a way that you can be transformed by your connection, and not speaking for them, right? You've got to listen to them and amplify their voices, but also be open to learning new things.
As authors diving into this topic, who do you feel is the audience for this book, or who do you ideally want to reach?
You know, that's a question that we thought about a lot, particularly with our editor. And I mean, on the one hand, there's an audience of people who have been in this situation, right? Who have been, you know, part of these movements, or who, you know, like people who now characterize themselves as ex-evangelical, who feel like they're survivors of some of the more toxic practices that they've experienced in evangelical churches. And finding words for the experiences that they've had has been really helpful for a lot of people. So that's great. But not being a religious person myself, I really hope that people like me will want to read it too. Like, you know, I'm queer. I left the church as soon as I could, basically. And what I learned from this movement is not just about, like, how to be a better Christian, right? It's about, like, the things that are really easy for me as an outsider to see as toxic dynamics are also toxic dynamics that exist within the left. And I hope that more than just the people that the book is specifically about will want to read it, because I think that they, you know, like, I mean, this is a group of people who practice saying things really well, who think really deeply about big questions, and who, you know, work to, you know, put their ideas and their love into bringing other people along on the path. And that path is sometimes liberating and life affirming, and you don't have to convert religions to learn from them.
And for you, Teresa?
Yeah, I would agree with everything that Dawn shared. I have similar feelings about who I hope will read this. I think one of the most powerful messages that kind of goes beyond the narrow group that we learned from and heard from is, what does it mean for love to be politically and morally motivating? When we say we want to love people that are not in our families or our friends, like, what does that mean? What does that look like? How can I engage in a love ethic and a love politics that's really aimed at justice? Like, what's the relationship between those two? So anyone who cares about that question, I think, can learn something from the book, can learn something from their stories, because they're trying to enact that and are having some success. And so that's not a new theme. That's a theme that activists and thinkers have talked about for a long time, but it's a contemporary iteration and practical movement of people trying to enact that. And they have some unique insight given their vantage point and their perspective and their place in contemporary American politics and society.
Well, Dawn and Teresa, I want to thank you both so much for joining me today to talk more about Choosing Love.
Thank you so much for having us. This has been a delight.
Dawn Moon is the Director of Interdisciplinary Gender and Sexuality Studies at Marquette University. Teresa Tobin is an Associate Professor of Philosophy at Marquette. Together, they're the co-authors of Choosing Love, What LGBTQ+ Christians Can Teach Us All About Relationships, Inclusion, and Justice. Did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcast, download, and listen on demand. In about 15 minutes, we'll learn about the history of Milwaukee's Silver City neighborhood in the latest Bulber Talk. But first, we'll bring you a new group chat conversation where two daughters of immigrants share their fears as they get ready to head off to college. That's coming up on Lake Effect on WUWM.
And kiss me goodnight. I need your love. I need love.
You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. College is supposed to be a time of excitement and new beginnings in a young person's life. But what if you're leaving behind your family, and some of them don't have legal immigration status in the U.S.? This month's group chat is a conversation between two recent high school grads and best friends, who amid widespread deportations worry about leaving their parents and siblings.
We just graduated a few weeks, and we're going off to college. There's a lot of changes coming, some good ones, some bad ones. What are you most excited for?
What I'm most excited for, of course, is getting to start over, because obviously since I'm the oldest, I get to be on my own for a little bit, which is also scary, but I'm excited for that because being the oldest, having to care with so much, so I feel like that time is for me to breathe and be alone for a little bit and know how it is, like the true adult life. You know?
What was your family's reaction when you told them that you were going to go a little far away for college?
Well, my mom, she was very, me apoyaba mucho, you know, like she didn't stop me from being like, oh, you know, that's too far. But my dad, on the other hand, he was like more afraid. And obviously, since he's undocumented, he was more afraid of what if I go and, you know, I don't come back. But now I think my parents had a talk and they were like, you know what, if that's what she wants, that's what's going to be, you know, nothing's going to change that. So
in my experience, for my parents, my mom was the same. She was like, oh, it doesn't matter where you go. It'll be fine. But once I told her that I was accepted, like, 11 hours away, she was like, you don't have to go if you don't want to. But it's definitely something I want to do as the oldest again.
Yeah.
I feel like it's a step or an example I'm going to set for my siblings. And I want to make sure that as the first, I'll be able to set a strong example.
How have your parents talked of what's happening with ICE? How do you,
like, how do we talk about
it?
They don't really tell me they're worried. They're just like, oh, this is what's happening, and this is how we should respond to it. So it's just like a lot of like planning. My mom already gave me like numbers and like addresses of like my aunts and my relatives. If I need help, they're the ones I can reach out to.
And I get it because, yeah, we're adults, but we're still little. Yeah. So my mom is like, oh, I used to your sister's birth certificate. I mean, I don't think I should know that because, like, that's the point where, like, okay, you know, this is real. I shouldn't be worried about this. Or my sister should be worried that they're not going to have their mom. And they're still growing. So I'm like, okay, I don't want that for them, you know. So it is such a big thing.
Have your siblings said anything about the situation at all?
My little sister, she's really...
What?
The eight-year-old.
Oh, okay.
So she didn't know what it was, right? So for me to explain it to her, it was difficult because, you know, she sleeps with me. At night, she's like, Mana, is mommy going to leave? Yeah. And it's hard, you know, because like I lived that. And I didn't want her to see, you know, like the first time Trump was elected, I was scared too. I was scared for my parents again, and again, I'm scared. And I didn't want her to see that. I didn't want any of them to see that. You know, I just don't want to go to school and them not be here because I don't want to. I just don't want to carry that. Not because I don't love my sisters, I don't love my family, but I want to live too. I know your little brother's been more with you, so.
Yeah, it's kind of the same. So since I am going far away, I'm kind of scared because we've made plans too. I feel like it's too much of a responsibility to have to like be the head of a household at, what, 18? Like, hello? I just think if anything were to happen, I'm going to be so far away that it's going to be so difficult to provide my family with help or, like, aid in some sort of way or try to help them out. And I'm just, I'm really scared for that. Like, that's one of the reasons I'm scared to go to college, because I'm going to be, like, gone. And yes, my mom's like, oh, it's a phone call away. But, like, in a case of an emergency, it's not that easy.
It's not that easy. It's really not. And, like, that's what I hate, because I'm glad they're trying not to scare us. But, like, them not making us, like, alert of stuff is, like, scarier, because you don't know how they feel, and they only want to carry that, and you want to try to help them, and it's like, oh, why are you not letting me?
Right.
Yes.
And it's just so difficult on me, because I want to be there. I want to help her, like, more now, because it's like my last moments with them. I feel like a necessity to do all of those things. Pero no se deja.
Yeah. I don't know, because, like, my mom recently, she started sharing her location. You never know. You never know. So I'm like, oh, ¿ya vienes? Or, like, are you almost here? You know, I'm watching her come home. I'm like, literally 5 minutes. I look at it 5 minutes later, I'm looking at it again. I just want to make sure she's okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Going back a little bit to, like, your responsibilities as the oldest, when you're gone, who do you think, like, your responsibilities will be given to?
Well, I think my younger sister, she's going to turn 15.
Mm-hmm.
I think she's the one that's going to take the responsibility, especially when my mom has to go. You know, like a little ticket, a parking ticket, I did that. I had to pay for those. I did everything. So I feel like she would have to learn. That's why, like, I'm doing, like, a little run trial before, like, you know, my mom has to do something, go with her, help her. Mm-hmm. She gets frustrated, though. She doesn't like to do it. I'm like, you're going to have to do it. I'm going to leave in 2 months. Like, we have to learn before I leave. And I think it's like, I get it, because me and you, we were the person that our parents helped the most.
Yeah.
And they didn't have to carry with that responsibility. But now that responsibility is removed from our shoulders and placed on theirs.
I know. And I feel kind of bad, because I've done it for so long.
Yeah.
Like, we've done it for so long.
Since I was three, literally.
No, but my sister, she's gonna turn 17. But again, I've done since we were little. Ask her. She knows.
And you don't really know.
I know. I'm like, okay, Google, how do I do this?
For real.
It's just, I feel like to adjust for her, it's gonna be very difficult at first. But again, it's not like I'm gonna be super far away. She can always call me. Cualquier cosa. Talking again about high school. We just graduated, and we got to experience the new administration in our last year, our senior year. So were there any specific, like, changes or reactions you saw in your last year of high school through this administration?
I remember the election. Everybody would leave early to go vote.
I went to vote, too. Yeah. It was my first time voting.
Yeah. I did see a lot of my friends, you know, go vote, and they had a little I voted sticker.
And they show it off to the
band. Yeah, I was like... You quisiera. But yeah, I just did see that when he won, a lot of fear set in. A lot of people didn't come to school for a little bit.
So the day, when was it? The day of the election, was it 4th? November 4th? 5th? Little sister, that was the day she was born.
Oh, yeah.
So I was in the hospital. And just before I went to meet my sister for the first time, I went to vote. It was pretty big for me. And then the day after to see that, I was like, oh. And then... School-wise, it was, again, because most of our friends and, like, everybody that could, they did their best to go vote. So
a lot of people, I would say, went, like, a lot.
To see that much, like, turnout and then get this result is kind of, like,
A question I have for you. What did it feel like, or, like, when I decided to make the tarjetas rojas?
Oh, my gosh. Okay, so... Before you made them and, like, were giving them out to us, I had seen them on, like, TikTok and, like, social media. And they were all like, oh, now that with the new administration, make sure your parents have these. And I saw this specific TikTok of a teacher making them for, like, her kindergarten students. And I was like, wait, I need to get my hands on these.
Yeah.
But to my understanding, and I have a couple at home, but it's just, like, print out little sheets. They're, like, really small, like, business card size. And it basically lists, like, the rights that all people should have, but undocumented people should remember that they have, that they shouldn't open the door, right?
Open the door, yeah.
Open the door, and that unless a warrant is given, they have the right to keep the door closed.
And silent.
And silent. Yes. They have the right to remain silent. I feel like in those times of, like, high stress when there's authority figures that are looking for you at your home, you kind of forget that. or like anywhere because these raids are happening everywhere. So I just wanted to make sure my parents had those. And when I heard you were making those, I was relieved. I helped you cut them out, right?
Yeah.
We all cut them out together. And then we made sure all of our friends had them too mm-hmm. for their parents.
I remember we gave it to our class.
Did we have to print more?
I think we did.
At the end.
We did.
And then when I got home, my mom has these like little like laminated sheet things, like mm-hmm. papers. So I laminated those and I put them in their wallets for both of them. The next day I was like, make sure that you have this with you, that you don't forget it.
Yeah.
And in case anything happens, show them this.
Yeah. When I saw that, I think we didn't go to school that day, the day before, right?
Yeah, I think we were off.
We were off. But when I saw the, I saw a lot of TikToks. I saw it on social media. And I was like, I don't have a printer. I don't have nothing. So me and my sisters were put to work. We were writing these down. We wrote them down. And I gave one to my sister, my mom, and my dad. And I was like, you know, I explained it to them. But obviously, you know, they don't care, but they should. Actually, like, they really should. But then the next day, I remember I emailed my teacher. I emailed her very last minute. I was like, oh, I think you should print these out for me. Like, I think this would be helpful.
Llegamos, and they were there, and we put them in.
Right away, put a work.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. We've been friends for, like, a good amount of our high school life. How does it feel that we're leaving? How are we going to keep in touch?
We're all going different ways.
We are.
We're all going to different colleges, which is mm-hmm. kind of crazy because I expected some of us to go like together. That's kind of scary.
I never thought I was going to leave. No, I didn't think.
But I know we'll keep in touch through like social media and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Our TikTok streak. ¿Cuántos días? Like 300 days?
Yeah.
300 days on that TikTok streak.
Almost a year.
So I know there'll be ways to communicate.
Yeah.
Since I know you guys really well, I know I won't be scared if you guys don't text me like every single day.
Yeah.
Like if it's like a monthly checkup thing, mm-hmm. like that's what we'll need. And we'll all be busy doing our own things, which I totally understand. So I think it's just going to be change at first because mm-hmm. we like talk on a day-to-day basis. It's just going to be a little hard to adapt to a few times a month or stuff like that.
I mean, I promise myself too, because I'm that type of person that when I see you anymore, I don't.
Please don't forget me. Please don't forget me.
I'm not. I won't. I trust. I put you in my college essay. But I think it would be difficult. But I would also understand, like, if you can't reach out, obviously you're going to be living your life. I'm going to be living mine. But, you know, a hi once wouldn't hurt. But, you know, I know that it's not going to be every day. It's going to be hard. Bro, I can hear myself laugh. Wait, actually, let's try it out.
Okay, ready? You ready?
ASMR.
Those were two recent Milwaukee High School graduates. They requested to be anonymous out of concern for their family's safety. Group Chat is our monthly segment featuring local voices that aren't typically heard, expressing their own opinions. It's produced by WUWM's Jimmy Gutierrez.
Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
I'm WUWM digital producer Graham Thomas. Just south of the Menominee River Valley and west of the Mitchell Park Domes lie Milwaukee's National Park and Silver City neighborhoods. Ever since listener Brandon Peyton Carrillo moved to National Park from Bayview in 2020, he's been curious about the history of the area.
I got this old Milwaukee map from 1898, and I was trying to find, you know, my house. And on the map there is like a green space. And I was like, oh, that's weird.
After some research, Brandon realized that his neighborhood was home to an amusement park in the late 19th century.
I want to know more about what this park was like.
I contacted Milwaukee historian John Gerda looking for answers. We'll get back to the park in a minute. But first, some background on the Silver City neighborhood.
That became a very German neighborhood in the later 1800s. And then as the years went on, it became so industrial, it attracted a lot of industrial immigrants. And these workers developed, as you would expect, a powerful thirst.
With 24 saloons at one point in the 1800s, Gerda says Silver City
was a drinking man's, working man's paradise. And back in those days, the early days of industrialization there, 1890s and so, you weren't paid by a direct deposit. You weren't paid by check. You were paid in silver coin. So these guys, whatever payday was, they'd get paid and they would belly up to the bar, and the counters would just be awash in silver. So I think the legend is somebody walked into one of the saloons and said, "This must be Silver City because of all the coins on the table." So that's where Silver City came from.
When factory workers and machinists from Harnischweiger, the Falk plant, and the Milwaukee road shops weren't spending their silver at the saloon, the nearby amusement park offered respite. The story of the park starts in 1883, when two local promoters bought a 44-acre tract of land at what is now 27th and National. They named this rural wooded retreat National Park, after the nearby National Soldiers' Home. They put in a small pond, a two-story pavilion with a ballroom, and a racetrack for trotting horse, bicycle, and eventually motorcycle races.
You also had the Scottish Highland Games were out there. You'd have labor picnics.
National Park was big enough to host fox hunts in the woods, despite objections from the Milwaukee Humane Society. In 1885, the park's crown jewel was built, Milwaukee's very first roller coaster. Guests could pay a nickel for two rickety rides around the coaster's 500-foot latticework loop. One Milwaukee Sentinel reporter who gave it a spin said,
"The sensation produced by the first ride is goneness. When the car reaches the last dip in the track, it attains a fearful velocity, which sends it to the starting point again." So it was kind of adrenaline, you know, back in 1885.
Goethe says by the end of the century, however, the park's 16-year joyride had run its course.
So back in 1899, a couple of Eastside entrepreneurs bought the entire parcel and announced that they would plan to, as they put it, cut it up into building lots. So when you look at that area today, the houses are of a very uniform age. Well, they're all very early 1900s, so the turn of the 20th century.
Which brings us back to Bubbler Talk question asker Brandon Peyton Carrillo.
My house is one of the last houses that was built in the neighborhood. This house is 100 years old this year.
Today, Silver City is known for its diverse food scene and access to the Menominee Valley via Three Bridges Park, the Hank Aaron Trail, and the Urban Ecology Center. Brandon hopes to make Silver City a neighborhood that's also known for its music scene. He's a musician and the organizer of Antonio Fest, Milwaukee's first ever Latin alternative music festival. And he wrote this song about his neighborhood called Silver City.
Support for Bubbler Talk comes from Educators Credit Union. What have you always wanted to know about the Milwaukee area? Visit wuwm.com/bubblertalk to submit your question.
We'll take one last break, and when we return, we'll tell you how you can learn where the fish you eat comes from through a series of photographs at the Maritime Museum. Keep listening to Lake Effect on WUWM. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Have you ever sat down for a Friday fish fry and wondered where that fried fish in a basket came from? A new exhibit at the Maritime Museum in Manitowoc helps people understand where the fish we eat actually comes from. It's called From Lake to Plate, and it tells the story of Wisconsin's fishermen, smokehouses, and even the delivery drivers. The story is captured through 50 years of photographs taken by Tom Kuchera and Jim LaGault. They join WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz at the exhibit.
So really from the beginning, when I started, you know, having these meetings and discussions with Joe here, I love the photos, I love the portraits. I could see why this was such a great story. It was a very good Milwaukee story. But here at the Wisconsin Maritime Museum, we cast a wider net, right? We have a broader storytelling scope. So I challenged Joe actually a little bit, if you remember, and let's see if we can marry the present fishing industry to the 1950s, 60s, when you really, your family, your photos were taken, your dad's photos. So that's kind of how we began then in, you know, interacting with Jim Legault, this other photographer who's still alive and practicing photography, a variety of different kinds. And these photographs are part of our collection that he's donated over the years, but they go back to the 1970s, and really it is the workers on these fishing tugs and out on the water. And so the process is, as you can see, from lake to plate, through the catch, into the processing, and then all the way kind of to behind the scenes in the workshop, in the offices of Empire Fish, and then finishing with the plate. You know, we both wanted to make sure that we kind of frame the history of Empire Fish and Milwaukee's story, but also bring it to the present in the contemporary sense. And by doing that, saying that the industry has gone through ups and downs, and it still will, ebbs and flows, peaks and waves even, and a lot of that has to do with ecology. So, you know, telling that story, but also realizing that this is an enduring tradition and we want to see it celebrated and endure for generations to come. So at the very end, you have a way to pick up some literature, Wisconsin fish markets with addresses and those QR codes and takeaways for people to like go and support these industries that you can find local caught perch or local caught whitefish, and even coho salmon that are out on the lake. So
what's the story of this beautiful model?
These are from our collection. We have so many models in the collection, and even early on, Joe, we were saying we don't want to make this about fish tugs and just like props and stuff.
It's about
the people. But I think it's important to frame it with these are the vessels that we identify with, even on the horizon historically. You know, there's not many left. So the first one is a cutaway, and this shows what it's like on the inside of one of these fish tugs. And this one is the Eagle model, and it's from the 1950s. And so with that, it's paired with the photography. Then you see, you know, even how they haul in the nets. And again, it kind of frames the scale, but also the technology. And again, it comes then down to the people. So each of these images has a human in it, typically, and that's the real thing.
Does this take us from down south along the lake to Door County, for example, or where does this journey take us?
It is kind of interspersed, as you can see. We didn't want to necessarily say, okay, just Milwaukee, but we did start a little bit with Port Washington here, because it does end even in Milwaukee over here on this side. So it was not necessarily geographically laid out, but really more in process and in time, temporally. So you see, I mean, really 1970s here to the present. So Jim took these over 50 years ago, almost 50 years ago, and then here, you know, even just in the last couple of years. And the families are still here, the Hickey brothers. So here's Dennis Hickey is here because he's blonde hair. And then as you get over here, you actually see him in the warehouse in the processing many years later.
That's the idea behind the fishing families connected to the foodways. Looking at the multi-generational businesses and understanding their connection to the lake and how they're bringing us the food that we eat.
Absolutely.
Which is why we begin the exhibit with the question, who are the people that bring us the food that we eat? And then to look at some of these small businesses that, you know, we are encouraging visitors to support, as shown on this map here. In working with Shelby Miller as a part of the project with El Verno College, we collected a lot of the oral histories. We supplemented that with some additional, you know, quotes and stories and, you know, my dad's photos of Empire Fish Company, Jim Legault's photos of his, you know, decades of capturing the family fish companies and fishermen.
You know, we're also trying to tell the stories. It's now an international demand. So fish are coming from Canada and Europe and beyond, Scandinavia. And what we're trying to also show is that you can find local catch right here from Lake Michigan, from the Bay of Green Bay. Sourcing those is, I guess, what we're hoping to do is just point some people in the right direction.
Right. Dovetailing with an initiative that really is sort of Great Lakes wide and trying to make the most of every fish that's harvested and
right.
its use goes as far as it can, from consumption to other use.
Yeah, and on that, the perfect projects. Example of Dan Schwartz, who's actually relative of Schwartzfish in Sheboygan, becoming an importer of fish from the Baltic states and then making gefilte fish using all the parts exactly like you're
there
saying.
You
so
go.
There's the example of what yeah. you're just saying that.
Like dog treats, natural fish product. So yeah, state-of-the-art facilities in Sturgeon Bay, you know, it's the evolution of this industry, right? From this model, kind of again, this is a diorama showing a 1950s kind of nostalgic view of how fishing was done historically, you know, and these buildings are still around. It's still part of our kind of cultural landscape. But the practice is changing, certainly, with how these fish are harvested, the quotas in which they have to work with. And of course, we still have recreational fishing and, you know, sport fishing. And that is part of the give and take of how much fish are available. What does the stock look like, which is always changing. But my son is currently right outside fishing in the Manitowoc River. So, you know, it shows that...
What's he fishing for?
Whatever was in there. I don't know. You know, every time we travel, he's just that's the thing. It's just, I think, innately interesting to a lot of us. It's a challenge, right, to try to pull something magnificent out of the water. And we did in Port Washington over the Christmas break. He caught a 27-inch trout, brown
wow.
trout, which we filleted, and he helped and did the processing, and we fried it up and even got some roe out of it. And it was an amazing experience to see it from lake to plate within a day. And,
wow.
And I guess that's the kind of parting that to the next generation. He's 12. But that, you know, inspires him to keep going out and looking for another fish. What these families have been doing in for generations is that, I think, that livelihood. It's also that challenge and that interest and the inspiration to keep doing it when it is very difficult work.
So this is my dad,
yeah.
and he incorporated his love of photography into his work at Empire Fish, leaving his camera here, his Leica camera, on his desk, and would, you know, occasionally snap a photo of one of the employees on the job, maybe tell a joke, get them smiling. This is my great-grandfather, Jerry Kuchera, in the original location of Empire Fish on Valit Street. You can see
sure.
the businesses across the street. You can see the herring and salt cod here. These ice bins utilized ice blocks from Lake Michigan. The way that my grandfather explained it to me was that ice would freeze over more often, and that was the refrigeration, the method of refrigeration, was buying it from the ice man and then putting the ice blocks in there and then using that as your refrigeration. You know, in looking back at the photos, what's really fun to see is, and again, the theme of the exhibit is to, so the fishing families that are very involved in the industry, and to see all the people that are bringing us the fish that we eat, you know, behind the scenes, but that create kind of a work family, if you will, that, you know, and to realize, oh, our fish doesn't come from just the big box retailers. These are the people that are handling it and bring our food. And
so your dad would have taken all of these, for example, or was it a mixture?
It's a mixture of mm-hmm. photos that my dad took, some historical photos of the company when they were getting ready for the new location. These are photos of the fishing vessels from the Wisconsin Marine Historical Society, and this is a painting of me at Empire Fish painted by my friend Zav LaPlay.
Amazing.
Yeah.
So who are these two happy ladies, do you know?
Yeah, Johnson. So Greta Johns and Elaine Johnson, they were owners of the Northern Lights Fish Company. It wasn't just about fishermen, but fisherwomen too, and the workers. So the gender aspect of this, you know, while it was challenging, and they were often not allowed on boats, and even today there's some pushback there. But you know, women in commercial industry, we have a whole panel just about that. So even the photographs, we wanted to reflect that the women behind the scenes are equally working as hard.
For me, this process in creating this exhibit, I've actually learned a tremendous amount. I mean, relating it to what Kevin said, the fish companies in the southern half of the lake, like Ewigs and Smith Brothers have shut down, many have shut down. Empire Fish Market is still a retail market there today. I learned how the industry is actually doing, is really coming back in the northern half of Lake Michigan. So even though the industry is, for the most part, disappeared from the southern half, the story in the northern half is quite different. So for me, that was a tremendous experience to
learn about that in putting this together. I like relating it back to your story of the son fishing because, you know, these are families that whose job was to connect the lake to the plate.
Yep.
And, you know, in today's modern society, we're so disconnected,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
But to come and just reflect on who those people are and to kind of bring us closer to the source and think about the businesses that we can patronize and support to bring us closer to the lake.
So does it make you want to jump back in the biz?
It's a tough business. It makes me appreciate it all the more. But I'm thrilled to have worked with Kevin here and the museum staff to make this reality. But I'll go get a fish fry.
Tom Kuchera and Jim LaGault are the photographers behind the exhibit From Lake to Plate, Local Fishing Families and Foodways. They spoke with WUWM's environmental reporter Susan Benz back in April, and the exhibit is at the Maritime Museum in Manitowoc through October of this year. And that's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Joy Powers, Sam Woods, and X-Grid Nunez join me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from Rob Larry and Graham Thomas. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. Emily Files helps edit the show. We also heard from Mayan Silver, Jimmy Gutierrez, and Susan Benz from the WUWM News Team this week. Jason Reavy is our studio engineer. Michelle Maternowski is our digital manager. Valeria Navarro-Viegas is our digital editor. Trapper Shep wrote our theme music. If you've missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you prefer to take us on the go, simply download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Join us again on Monday at noon to learn how flooding risks have increased in Wisconsin due to climate change. Plus, we'll learn about a storefront that aims to reduce food waste and help farmers make the most of their produce year-round. Thank you so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.